Good morning. Thank you all for being here to share the Dharma together today. And welcome to our guests. During these teishos, it's perfectly okay to change your posture if need be. But however you sit, do keep the head up and the back straight. Next Sunday, we will be holding our annual precepts ceremony. It's one of the most important events on our calendar. It's an opportunity to make a vow of commitment or a recommitment to the Buddha's way. Anyone who wishes to may participate. But the ceremony is not to be taken lightly. One of the purposes of this teisho that's offered each year at this time is to emphasize the serious and profound nature of this commitment. All three of the teachers here have, each in their own way, defined and expressed this dharma of the precepts. It's an ongoing part of our job. So what I'm doing here is a continuation of that process. And it's really what we all do in our lives. The precepts are the truth of the life and practice of all who walk this path. But they're not a set of rules and regulations, of do's and don'ts. They're not anything that you can hang on to, nothing that you can write down and stick to the refrigerator. The Buddha way is not about what we know, what we think, what we imagine or conceive of. We call it a way or a path because it is to be walked. It is to be lived. The precepts must manifest in our lives, where the rubber meets the road, as it were. So just as a review, let's look at the 16 precepts altogether. There are the three refuges that are part of our regular chanting service. I take refuge in Buddha. I take refuge in Dharma. I take refuge in Sangha. And there are the three general resolutions. I resolve to avoid evil. I resolve to practice all good dharmas. I resolve to save the many beings. And then there are the 10 grave precepts. These are the specific ways in which we manifest those first 6. The specifics are important. It's easy to say avoid evil and practice good, but it's not much help in our everyday lives. What does all that mean when we get up in the morning? So we have not to kill, but to cherish all life. Not to steal, but to respect the things of others. Not to engage in improper sex, but to live a life of purity and restraint. Not to lie, but to speak the truth. Not to give or take drugs that dull the mind, but keep the mind clear at all times. Not to discuss the faults of others, but to be sympathetic and understanding. Not to praise oneself and abuse others, but to overcome one's own shortcomings. Not to withhold spiritual or material aid, but to give freely where needed. Not to indulge in anger, but to exercise control. And not to defame the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but to cherish and uphold them. Anyone who has embarked on this journey must make the precepts a part of their practice. Without the basis of the moral teachings of the Buddha, The practice of Zazen becomes just another esoteric hobby that you can use to impress people at cocktail parties. Those who have committed to a course of formal training with a teacher work with the precepts at least three times. First, as part of the practice of every minute Zen. That's the practice of mindfulness in our lives. Second, those who make the very profound commitment of Jukai, taking the Raksu and a Buddhist name, have to write a paragraph and a verse that expresses their understanding of each of the precepts. And finally, at the end of one's formal koan training, one engages the precepts as koans. The precepts are all about human activity by human beings. There's nothing about God or gods to be propitiated or to be defied. It is we ourselves, each one of us, who work to deepen our understanding through the practice of the precepts for the benefit of all beings. We can look at the precepts in three ways. There's a literal view, and then there is the absolute or emptiness view, and then there is the compassionate or the bodhisattva view. Now, ultimately, these are three aspects of the same reality. But let's consider each of them in turn. From the literal standpoint, it's very simple. Do not kill. Ever. End of discussion. Don't kill. Don't lie. Take no drugs. And so on. No excuses. No exceptions. If we look at the first precept, not to kill. In order not to kill, certain Buddhist and other sects wear filter masks so as not to inadvertently harm any microorganisms that might be in the air. They filter the water they drink for the same reason. And of course, they are very careful about where they walk. Philip Kaplow Roshi told a story of his stay at a Theravadan monastery. One day he found his little cabin infested with ants. Well, he wasn't quite sure what to do about them. He tried talking to them, but that didn't seem to work. So he asked the head monk. The monk came to his cabin with a very soft, fluffy brush, very carefully swept the ants out of the door. One might think that this literal view is naive, too rigid. After all, just by being alive, we kill. Anyone who has a functioning immune system kills all the time. We spray swamps and stagnant ponds to kill mosquitoes that carry deadly diseases in order to save human lives. We constantly make decisions about what to kill that some other form of life can live, especially us. Now, we could try to weasel out of it by saying that it's a matter of intent, attaching to the thought of killing. If I'm out driving somewhere and a squirrel darts out in front of the car and gets squashed, can I say that since I didn't intend to kill it, I have not violated the precept and will suffer no karmic consequences? Well, maybe. But I did make a conscious decision to drive a car, knowing full well the risks. Not to give or take drugs which dull the mind, but to keep the mind clear at all times. Well, that has to include alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine. I wonder if there's anyone here who has never touched alcohol, or coffee, or tea, or painkillers, or cold medications, or antihistamines, or antidepressants. Yet we provide meds to those who need them. Drugs correctly used can prevent suicide, cure an otherwise fatal illness, or just allow someone to function normally. What about not to lie, but to speak the truth? Several years ago now, there was a movie called Liar, Liar, starring Jim Carrey. It's about a man who falls under a spell of having to tell the absolute literal truth all the time. Carrey's performance in the movie is hilarious, but it makes a very serious point. Think about it. Could one do that? We tell little white lies to smooth our way in all kinds of situations and relationships. Has anyone here never lied, never engaged in irresponsible sex, never spoken slightingly of another, never hung on to their anger, never had the occasional martini? These are all violations of the precepts. There's no escaping it. Nevertheless, the examination of this view is the entry into the precepts, and it's very important to study our own lives in this light. To realize that we violate all the precepts just about all the time is very humbling. We are born with this human body-mind. By definition, we will never be perfect in our lives or in our practice. And yet we continue to live and we continue to practice. And in doing so, we see ourselves more and more clearly as human beings, not as some kind of Zen Buddhist superstar. But if we stop there, we are incomplete. Our practice is incomplete. So we have the other side, the absolute or the emptiness view. Bodhidharma said, "The self nature is inconceivably wondrous in the realm of the everlasting Dharma. Not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing." In other words, killing is a thought that arises in the mind, not in the great reality. In this absolute view, there is no one to kill, nothing to be killed, and no act of killing. Not a cloud in the empty sky. But to say that these three wheels are empty is in no way a justification for killing, or for lying, or for stealing. Takuan, a Zen teacher of the Tokugawa era in Japan, advised samurai in training as follows. He said, "The mind is not detained by the hand that brandishes the sword. Completely oblivious to the hand that wields the sword, one strikes and cuts his opponent down. He does not put his mind in his adversary. The opponent is emptiness. I am emptiness. The hand that holds the sword itself is emptiness." Do we see the problem here? This is another completely one-sided view. All form is emptiness, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. In this view, because there is nothing, nothing matters. All is permitted. Robert Aitken Roshi cautions us, "Be careful not to slip into an antinomian position. How about if this very mind tells you to take up a pistol and shoot somebody? Is that Buddha?" Buji Zen people might say, "Yes, of course." They wander in the limbo of pernicious oneness where there is no purpose, no meaning and certainty, and certainly no Dharma wheel. The Buddha, which is this very mind and body, is completely disregarded. So there we are. To to look at the absolute as if nothing exists, therefore nothing matters, is to miss it. And to attach to a zero-tolerance policy is equally to miss it. Chertow says, do not judge by any standards. No, you cannot set up rules to be followed. Don't get caught up in notions of success and failure. Setting up an unattainable goal of perfection or virtue is one way that the ego perpetuates itself. If one is successful, that's just feeding the ego. If one fails, that too is feeding the ego. And that which demands freedom from all constraints of behavior is also the ego self retreating into a nihilistic complacency. We can't fall to the side of form, nor to the side of emptiness. What do we do? This great conundrum is addressed directly in one of the most painful and difficult koans we work on. Case number 14 of the Wu Men Guan reads in part, once, when the monks of the Western and Eastern halls were quarreling about a cat, Nan Chuan, holding up the cat, said, you monks, if any of you can speak an appropriate word of Zen, I will spare the cat. Otherwise, I will cut it in two. No one could answer, so Nan Chuan cut it in two. Was that killing? Has Nan Chuan committed an atrocity? If you say yes, you are attached to the cat and notions of killing, not killing, good and evil, and on and on. If you say no, you are stuck in emptiness. You ignore the fact of the blood and gore and a dead cat. A little while ago we chanted, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. The great unfathomable void is none other than the blood, sweat, and tears of our lives. It is people, clouds, car exhaust, children. It is life, death, and everything in between. In the great reality, the oneness view, the absolute view, is not a denial. It is the deep understanding of non-separation, that we ourselves are all phenomena, and all phenomena are you and me. This is prajna, the wisdom that transcends all wisdom. The two views are in no way separate. If you genuinely realize one, you realize the other. And it's from a careful examination of the literal and absolute views of the precepts that the third view emerges, the realization of compassion. How does this compassion manifest itself? If you try to plan, you miss it. If you carry in you some image of compassionate action or of your compassionate self, you miss it. If you think Mother Teresa, Albert Schweitzer, Mahatma Gandhi, you miss it. That which plans is yet again the ego self. Realization of compassion is not the images, the thoughts, or the intentions. It is realization, making it real in our actions. And where does that lead us? Is there any such thing as killing as an act of compassion? A situation where you are fully aware of killing and yet you do it? There are doctors who will acknowledge that in order to relieve suffering, they will prescribe large doses of painkillers, which undoubtedly shorten the patient's life. We kill a terminally ill pet in order to end its suffering. There are those who advocate we do the same with people. Is that compassion? Don't even try to answer that. Words will never tell us. So then, do we look for a middle way? And what does that mean? Do we make up all sorts of scenarios, exceptions, special cases? Here's what you do if... Take every possibility into account. Cover all the bases. There are books on ethics and Buddhist ethics that do exactly that. They present all the situations the authors can think of, quote voluminously from scripture to back it all up. One might call this the Talmudic approach to the precepts. And as Yen Wu might say, fortunately, this has nothing to do with the matter. The middle way is not an average or a compromise. It is not something you figure out. It is a new direction that transcends any concepts of form and emptiness. This compassionate view is what I would call the real world view. And by real world, I mean the great reality, that which transcends all notions of form, emptiness, ignorance, enlightenment, good, evil, and so on. So now we get to it. Not studying or examining or interpreting, but practicing the precepts. How? We watch. We pay attention moment by moment. We learn about ourselves in the world of time, space, and karma. And we sit zazen. We quiet the mind. This leads to awareness. But it is a dispassionate, non-judgmental awareness of the self in the largest sense. If we persist, a change occurs over time. The awareness is itself the change. You have to come out of your own practice and realization. Not mine, not Nanchuan's, not even the Buddha's, but your own. Only then does your compassion indeed become Nanchuan's and the Buddha's. But don't look for easy answers. Here are a couple of stories that may shed some light. There's a passage in the novel David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, in which David escapes from the slave labor forced on him by an evil stepfather, and he makes his way to the house of a distant aunt and throws himself on her mercy. The aunt's name is Miss Trotwood. Now, living with Miss Trotwood is a Mr. Dick, an elderly gentleman whom we might nowadays call developmentally disabled, but upon whom she relies for advice. Faced with the dilemma of young David asking for sanctuary, she asks Mr. Dick what to do with this boy. Mr. Dick hems and haws, looks a bit panicky, and finally says, "We should feed him." Later, in a confrontation with the stepfather, who is demanding David's return, she again asks Mr. Dick what to do with this boy. Mr. Dick fumbles and stutters and then says, "We should measure him for a suit of clothes." And Miss Trotwood announces triumphantly, "You see, Mr. Dick puts us all right." Mr. Dick is not burdened with any notions of compassion. I doubt that he could spell compassion. He just saw clearly what was in front of him. If a child is hungry, you feed it. If it's ragged, you clothe it. It's all he needs. It's all any of us need if we just knew it and had faith in it. There's a story about Philip Kaplow Roshi. In the early days of his tenure as abbot of the Rochester Zen Center, He was very, very strict in his view of the precepts, particularly the one about drugs and alcohol, which dull the mind. He was totally against alcohol or any other of what we would call the recreational drugs. At this time, Roshi was very active in touring the country with a cadre of his disciples, giving workshops and seminars, somewhat similar to the ones we have here about three times a year. At one of them, after a lecture on the precepts during the Q&A, a man stood up and asked, "What about alcohol?" Well, Roshi's assistants all ducked for cover, waiting for the explosion. Roshi looked at the man for a long moment and then said, "Sometimes alcohol can help you through a bad time." And thereafter, Roshi would have the occasional glass of wine at dinner. Did he fall off the wagon? Or did he learn something? What did he see? A great teacher is also a great student. What can I learn from this moment and this place? Now, some of these might seem pretty easy, even self-evident. Here's a tougher one. I recall an incident from many years ago. My mother-in-law, Helen, had a sister who married a guy who, when I met him, weighed about 300 pounds, was diabetic and an alcoholic. One night they came to visit Helen in her apartment. Don had been on a strict diet and abstinence program for several months. He'd lost some weight and had apparently sobered up. That night, he walked in, collapsed into a chair. He didn't say anything, but he was absolutely miserable. Helen took one look at him and said, "Don, do you want a drink?" He nodded, "Yeah." Helen got out the vodka, poured him a stiff one, left the bottle on the table. What was that? Did Helen see clearly? If you ask me, I can only say, darned if I know. There's that old saying that no battle plan ever survived contact with the enemy. Yeah, no principle, opinion, or philosophy ever survived contact with reality. We cannot predict or prescribe for ourselves. How much less can we do it with respect to others? This is why we insist that the precepts are not commandments. A command implies that you have certain knowledge of the future, which is a pernicious illusion. The Buddha himself never commanded anybody. He admonished, he cajoled, he encouraged, but he never commanded. This real transcendent world is where we find out that there are no pat answers, no rule book that we can refer to. There is nothing to cling to, no philosophy, no ethical system, no examples, no precedents, nowhere to stand. No policy, no set of rules, no principles apply. We can go through all sorts of discussions about the precepts, but ultimately they come down to the moment. You can't plan ahead. Yes, we fail. We fail constantly. That's okay, as long as we don't give up on ourselves, as long as we continue our work. Thich Nhat Hanh said it's like the North Star. Nobody seriously expects to get to the North Star, but to move in that direction is enough. So next Sunday, when we commit to the precepts, we are committing to the unknown. We have no clue as to what we will do in any given situation until it happens. The notion that we can choose between known outcomes is an illusion. There is no chain of events. There is only this moment, here and now. Then, whatever we do, just happens. In case number 89 of the Blue Cliff Record, Yunyan asked Dao Wu, "What use does the great Bodhisattva of compassion make of all those hands and eyes?" Dao Wu said, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night." Yunyan said, "I understand." Dao Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yunyan said, "The whole body is hands and eyes." Dao Wu said, "You have had your say, but you have only said 80% of it." Yunyan said, "How would you put it?" Dao Wu said, "The outside is hands, the inside is eyes." Well, you know what? I like Yunyan's answer better. The whole body is hands and eyes. Notice there's nothing about the brain or the mind. Just hands, just eyes, just seeing, just doing. If you look at the Kanon altar in the Doksan waiting area, you will see the Kanon figure with several heads and a huge array of hands radiating out from her body. Hands and eyes. Eyes to see clearly, hands to act appropriately. Hands and eyes, seeing and doing. Or is it the other way around? Doing and seeing. Does it matter? In other depictions of Guanyin or Kanon, each hand is shown with an eye in the palm. In our deepest awareness, seeing and doing are not separate. If you put them in a timeline, then you are trapped in cause and effect, the chain of events fallacy. I saw this, therefore I did that, and such happened. Or maybe it didn't. I see that, and so I do this, and such will happen. Or maybe not. The whole body is hands and eyes. This very body, the body of Buddha. The body of Buddha, all bodies, all Buddhas throughout space and time. If there is truly no separation between self and other, past and future, there can be nothing but compassion. It is simply the state of our being and of all being. If we truly grasp the great matter, then even such notions as compassion are no longer necessary. Is a tree conscious of compassion when it gives shade? Or the sun when it gives light? I hope everyone's thoroughly confused at this point. When we commit to the precepts, we are committing to one thing that we can count on under any circumstance, and that is practice. The one thing that can never be taken away. It is what Dogen meant when he called effort the last refuge of all. So in committing to the precepts next week, we are not committing to any image of perfection, not even to compassion as a goal. We commit to the practice. The precepts are the practice. Practice is the precepts. The practice is never perfect, never will be perfect, and yet it transcends all notions of perfect and imperfect. So, what are you willing to do? Are you willing to commit to the unknown? Are you willing to go you know not where by a road you know not of? Consider well. Together with all beings, we realize the way.